Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins has released a list of 136 police officers who may have credibility problems as potential prosecutorial witnesses. The list has been garnering a great deal of attention since Rollins released it around 9 p.m. Friday night, as people were protesting the Breonna Taylor decision in the streets of Boston amid a heavy police presence. Now, Rollins is one of four Massachusetts district attorneys who've now released these Brady lists publicly. The name is a reference to a 1963 Supreme Court case that requires prosecutors to turn over any evidence that might be favorable to the defense, such as information about a police officer accused of overtime fraud or convicted of criminal charges or found not credible by a judge. We caught up with D.A. Rollins an hour ago and asked her how she created the list.
We inherited a list of 12 people, so we significantly increased the numbers regarding who was eligible. And we not only went through our own information regarding who we had either prosecuted or been made aware of, but we also added names that my colleagues, other district attorneys, had put on their list, as well as information we learned through the media. For example, nine Boston police officers that were indicted by the U.S. attorney with an investigation by the FBI, or, for example, many, many state troopers that were in a similar situation as well with respect to federal charges.
Let's pick up on that for a second. As you know, Middlesex County DA Marion Ryan's office requests the police departments in her county to notify her office of internal investigations into officers and information about those investigations. We noticed that you source most information on internal investigations in this database to Boston Globe reporting. So I wanted to ask, are you also asking local police to notify you about their internal investigations? And if you're asking, are they responding and giving you that information?
So we are in the process. I'm very proud of the relationship I've worked to cultivate, and it is a mutual relationship between Commissioner Gross, Colonel Mason, and the four other chiefs, Transit, Winthrop, Chelsea, and Revere, that are in Suffolk County. Although we only have six police departments, we have the two largest police departments in the Commonwealth, in the state police and in the Boston police. And after the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, we started meeting far more frequently. And so we are in contact and communication often and are going to be coming up with some criteria regarding notification. So that is in the process as well.
Yeah, you know, I did wonder about that because you've been vocal as a reformer since even before you were elected. And I wondered, does this list, the act of maintaining it and making it public, complicate your relationship with local law enforcement or make it harder for you to work with departments on prosecutions?
It shouldn't. You know, the overwhelming majority of the men and women that do this job do it with honor and dignity and compassion and character and aren't on this list. Many of the individuals that are listed no longer are in the employ of any of these entities, so don't work for the state police or Boston police, which are, of course, the two largest numbers. You know, we had over 130 people on our list, and we only have six cities and towns. Middlesex has less than that in over 50 cities and towns. Berkshire just released theirs, I think, today or yesterday. They have eight people on their list. I work very, very hard to make sure that we are not surprising anyone. We have had multiple meetings, not only with management with respect to law enforcement, so the colonels, the chiefs, and the commissioners, but I made sure to meet with every single one of the union presidents or leaders of all of the police unions. So, for example, I met with Colonel Mason of the state police, but there are two heads of the union for the state police. I met with Commissioner Gross for Boston, but there are four heads of the four unions at the Boston Police Department. We paid them the respect that they are due prior to us releasing this to the media. And I think that's why, even if we don't agree on things, it is really important that we pay each other the respect that we deserve regarding being, partners in law enforcement.
So now that this list is in place, what happens if an officer who appears on the list shows up in a case that you are prosecuting?
Well, what will happen is, remember, disclosure does not necessarily mean admissibility. But because as prosecutors, we hold virtually every card in the deck in our hands, and defendants don't. It is not appropriate for me to turn my back on a defendant and peer through a file and say, I did a review. There's nothing you need to see here. We disclose is Brady material that we, you know, we have an obligation to turn over. I'm proud in Suffolk County. We go above and beyond that. Now, ultimately, it may be admissible or it may not be, but the initial disclosure is what we're talking about in the law enforcement automatic discovery database. Disclosure does not necessarily mean admissibility.
You mentioned earlier that some of the people on this list are no longer police officers. We reached out to every department on the list and found that at least 40 of the officers named remain employed. I know that you have said you were dissatisfied with your predecessor's list because it included so many former officers. Why do you have so many non-active officers on this list now? Is it that they're likely to still come up in a case? Do you have more culling to do? What is that part about?
Well, because I actually am committed to not only looking forward with respect to the crimes that are happening now and solving them, but also looking backwards to make sure the decisions my office has made in the past were correct and constitutional and ethical. So, for example, when we know of a Fred Clay who's been exonerated, where the Boston police used hypnotism in order to find him guilty of a crime, there's problems there. And why we, in our first disclosure, have officers that maybe haven't worked in law enforcement for years, if not more. It is imperative that we are aware of who we are dealing with, because with the increase in requests for our Integrity Review Bureau, which would be, you know, false convictions, actual innocence, constitutional violations, when we look back to see if we got it right, I want to know who we were dealing with then. If it's an officer that has had multiple infractions or possibly even a conviction that we weren't aware of, that's going to be important as we look backwards to see and try to recreate what occurred in the past. So we are keeping people that are no longer employed. Or, for example, Patrick Rose Sr., who's the former president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. You know, if we're going to be getting there are outcries regarding recollections of from decades ago, or whether there is immediate harm that might have happened within the last 2 years. We want to know, even though he retired a few years back, what he has done. These things are important for us to know, because we are in a world now where we're looking backwards as often as we're looking forward.
And just to note, Patrick Rose is newly charged. He's a former Boston Police Union president accused of sexually abusing 4 children. And the other case you were talking about, 5. Thank you for the correction. And the other case you were talking about, just for our listeners, is a 1981 case where, as you say, the defendant was exonerated later. I want to ask you, we've been speaking to defense attorneys since the list came out. I want to play some sound from defense attorney David Nathanson, who specializes in post-conviction defense.
I'm hoping that this is the beginning of a process of getting more fairness, more justice, more transparency for people who are charged with crimes, especially serious crimes, in Suffolk County.
Is that your goal, too? And if so, what else do you think you need to do to get there?
It's absolutely my goal. And we, you know, we worked with obviously members of law enforcement and their unions, but we also, you know, had a quick conversation with some members of the criminal defense bar regarding what we would like this to look like. And, you know, ultimately for me, we have built into this process an ability to appeal, right? We have built into this process with respect to certain crimes, an ability to have the same time frame where things might not be admissible as we give to normal residents of Suffolk County and the Commonwealth. So, for example, if you're charged with a misdemeanor, usually now after the crime bill in 2018, it's 3 years that's no longer admissible. And before, felonies used to be 7 or 10 years, and now they're less. than that. So we've built into this process far more than many individuals get. For example, in the gang database, which has had lots of controversy, you are put in there because you happen to live on Humboldt Ave, or one of your relatives might be an affiliated alleged gang member. There's no built-in process of appealing your way out of that or rolling out of that gang database. We are giving police far more than law enforcement often gives members of over-policed and over-prosecuted communities. And we made sure that we did that because we'd like this to be a best practice and a gold standard that others will follow.
So last question for you, D.A. Rollins. Berkshire County District Attorney Andrea Harrington also just released her office's police officer disclosure list. So we're now at four D.A.'s offices who are keeping these public Brady lists. Do you think all 11 D.A.'s should be doing this?
I do. But, you know, ultimately, it's their prerogative. I mean, our Supreme Judicial Court has made it clear they believe that is a best practice that we should be following. And, you know, I just think transparency is always better. There is no profession. Let's take our spotlight off of the police right now. There is not a single profession you can name where there is 0% bad, you know, actors. Every single profession has individuals that, you know, unfortunately don't meet the high standards that are required. I think there are certain professions where you don't get to make, you know, those type of mistakes. And with respect to law enforcement, in particular the police, where they have the ability to take away your life, quite frankly, and split second decisions and your liberty with respect to arrests. You know, and me as a prosecutor who gets to make determinations that take away individuals' liberties and deeply impact their life, we have to be beyond reproach. So I'm excited that, you know, I've joined with several of my other colleagues, and we hope that, you know, with Suffolk County leading the way with the most individuals, even though we only have six cities and towns, that some of our brothers will join us.
And that was Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins. WBUR reporter Allie Jarmanning is on the line with us and heard that conversation. Allie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So let me just start by asking you what stood out for you from what you just heard.
Yeah, a couple things. She noted that before releasing the list, she met with all the police commissioners or chiefs for the departments with officers on the list and the police unions. And she said that was out of respect for them. She also said she's working with the police departments to figure out a way for the DA's office to be notified about troubled officers who might have pending internal affairs investigations. And that's something Middlesex DA Marion Ryan says she does in compiling her list. And the last thing, almost two-thirds of the 136 officers on the Suffolk list are no longer employed by the police departments. But Rollins said it's important to keep the officers on the list to ensure the integrity of convictions that may have taken place many years ago.
Allie, you and our Radio Boston colleague Walt Wuthman have been reporting on these Brady lists around the state for a little while now. Can you kind of give us the rundown of who has what right now among the 11 district attorneys?
Yeah, so we asked all 11 DA's offices for their lists. And at the time, we found only three of the 11 had an actual robust list, and that was Middlesex, Norfolk, and Suffolk counties. And as you said, before, Berkshire County just released its list on Friday as well, so that makes four. And as Rollins pointed out, all of the DA's offices led by women in the state have released their Brady list publicly now. But five DA's offices don't have anything. And that makes defense attorneys question how they're living up to their legal requirement to turn over information about discredited cops. And just for a little more context, when we asked the other DA's for their list, Rollins actually initially refused to provide it. Her office said it was attorney work product and so was exempt from disclosure under the public records law. We appealed to the state supervisor of records and won, and that led to the release of the list on Friday.
So now that it's released, how are people responding to the Suffolk County list?
So we've been speaking to a lot of defense attorneys, and I'd say the message is great first step, but let's keep it going. And as you and the DA talked about earlier, they want to see more access to internal affairs and disciplinary information instead of just issues that have already been publicly reported. We've also been trying to speak to police, but the Boston Police Department has so far not given us a comment on it. And the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, which represents many of the department's officers, they haven't responded either. We did hear from Chelsea Police Chief Brian Kies. He noted both officers named on Rollins' list are no longer employed by Chelsea. And he said, quote, "We continue to ensure that all of our officers are held to the highest ethical standards and to the highest level of transparency and accountability."
So I know you're going to continue to report on this Brady List larger story. What are you watching for?
Well, I want to see how Rollins and the other DA's lists change over time. If we ask for these lists 6 months from now, will we see more or fewer officers on the list? And or will they release them regularly without us asking? And it'll be interesting to see if Rollins releasing this list creates more pressures for other DAs to follow suit. And as Rollins mentioned, the state's highest court recently came out with a ruling that strengthened the disclosure requirements for prosecutors. And the Supreme Judicial Court said, well, they don't have the authority to require prosecutors maintain a Brady List, quote, "We strongly recommend that they do." So we'll see if more DAs take the court's advice.
Yeah, and we will watch to see what happens there. That's WBUR reporter Allie Jarmanning. Allie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It is the moment we have all been waiting for, or maybe dreading, depending on how you feel about presidential debates. But tonight, President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden are going to take the debate stage for the first time in Cleveland. Now, for the president, it is about shaking up the race.
Together, we are taking back our country. We are returning power to you, the American people.
While for Joe Biden, it's about staying focused on the task at hand.
What I'm not going to do is play the Trump game. I am focused on one thing right now, and I really mean it.
So let's talk about that. What are you watching for in tonight's debate? Are you watching tonight's debate? And what do you feel like is at stake for you? What do you think each candidate needs to do to have a successful performance, or as they might say, win? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us to take that look at what might happen tonight is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, hello there.
Hey, Tiziana.
And Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook and co-host of the Horse Race podcast. Hey, Stephanie, welcome to you, too.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Anthony, first debate between the two tonight. What are you looking for with Trump and Biden?
Well, like you said, we've been waiting for this for a long time. I mean, I think these two guys have two very different jobs. I mean, I think Trump has got to do something if he wants to rescue his campaign to sort of change the narrative. I mean, he's behind in national polls. He's behind in key swing state. He's behind in the money race. So this isn't a good moment for him. And with the nation focused on the pandemic and most Americans thinking that he's mismanaged the pandemic, he's got to find a way to somehow use this debate to change the narrative and get people to focus on something else. For Joe Biden, I think in a way it's clear what he has to do. He basically has to show the nation that he can be presidential, especially compared to Donald Trump. And I think Trump will try to rattle him. And I think Biden is going to try to stay focused on sort of the binary issues. Look, the Republicans want to do things like take away health care and overturn Roe v. Wade. We want to keep it. And that's what I think he's going to focus on. And if he does that,
oh, I think we lost Anthony there for just a second. I'm sure the control room will try to get him back, Stephanie. But in the meantime, let me turn to you and say, okay, so what does success look like? At the end of the night, if Donald Trump has been successful, he's done X. And if Joe Biden is successful, he's done Y.
Just as Anthony said, I think tonight is a big chance for Donald Trump to turn things around. Like Anthony said, his review on the coronavirus response is not great. He's down in most of the metrics that we have, money, polling, and otherwise. So for him, what will be a win is kind of shaking things up and taking the attention off of all of these kind of negative stories that have broken about the president lately. I'm thinking about the New York Times investigation into his taxes and to shift the conversation to something else. And for Joe Biden, what's interesting here is that the Trump campaign and President Trump himself have kind of set the bar low for Biden. They've painted him as somebody who isn't totally mentally there and messes up when he's speaking a lot. They've kind of put this narrative out there that Biden wanted more breaks in the debate or that he looks at a teleprompter, things that his campaign has denied. So as long as Biden gets in there and has a debate where he doesn't really make too many mistakes and shows that he's fit to debate, it will be kind of a positive for him. So in that regard, I think President Trump has kind of made the debate a little bit more difficult for himself by setting the bar so low for Joe Biden.
Anthony Brooks, do we have you back?
I believe I'm back.
Welcome back, Anthony. So before I go to the calls, let me just ask you, you know, there is often sort of this sense going into a debate that somebody has the advantage. I think there might have been a time when we would have thought that was whoever was up in the polls. I don't know if that is still the case. Is there somebody who has a better advantage going into tonight? And does that or does that not line up with the polls?
I look at the polls and I sort of look at all those issues that we were talking about. I mean, while polls aren't predictive, they do sort of tell us something about trends. So I think, you know, you have to say that going into the debate, Biden has an advantage. On the other hand, Trump is, you know, great at sort of mixing things up and creating chaos and sort of directing the terms of the debate. So in that sense, you might say he's got a bit of advantage. But I think Stephanie's absolutely right. By setting the bar so low, if Joe Biden does anything more than, doesn't do anything less than come out and sort of drool in his suit, people are going to say, oh, well, that wasn't so bad. And he'll do just fine, you know, because Trump has tried to create this image that somehow he's an old doddering fool over the hill. And actually, in the last one-on-one debate with Bernie Sanders, you know, Biden held his own and did pretty well. And I think Trump made a big mistake in trying to set the bar so low for him.
Yeah, I find that so interesting. If during the primaries you had said to me, if Joe Biden is the nominee, that the thing will be that the bar will be so low for his debate performance that it won't be hard for him to hurdle it, I think that would have been very surprising. It seems like it shows a lot about what's changed over the last 6 months. Let's grab our first call. We've got Kelly on the line from Newton, New Hampshire. Kelly, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to start by saying that I've worked on many Democratic campaigns, Barack Obama's being the most recent, and have been a longtime Democratic voter just through my family lines. And I just really usually look forward to debates, but I just feel like this debate is just so different. I think that his base, basic Trump base, will believe and follow whatever he says, that whatever Joe Biden says will be mocked or ripped on as fake news, and that it just gives his base an opportunity to be emboldened. And I think that most of I'm in my mid-30s, and most of my friends and people I speak politics with say the same thing, that it just feels like a debate is so futile at this point.
For that, Kelly. I appreciate that. It's a sad sentiment, but I appreciate you calling in and sharing it. Before I turn back to our panelists, let me grab one more call here. We've got Bettina in Beacon Hill. Bettina, go ahead.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. I just wish to correct things a little bit. Say, I'm a North Slope Beacon Hiller and have been since 1941 in the same house, and I was not born
here. All right.
Now, my question my hope for tonight is that Biden, of course, will dwell on the COVID, but he also, no matter what the questions are, will bring up the question of taxes, because there's so much resentment among the group that support Trump. I think one of the great things that they can talk about, of course, is the lack of paying taxes compared to everybody else.
So thanks for that, Bettina. And I'll take it there to Stephanie Murray, because we can put those together. Stephanie, is anything anyone's going to say likely to sway anyone who might watch or pay attention to the debate? What do we know about that? And is there going to be traction on this latest news about Trump's tax returns?
Well, Joe Biden gave us a hint regarding the tax returns today by releasing his. Biden, his family, they released their tax returns, as did his running mate Kamala Harris. And they did that today, which kind of sets the tone. So you can expect him, or I think we can all expect Biden to bring up the taxes because he did that. But on the topic of whether the debate's going to change anything, I think that's a great question. It feels like, as much as big and important and heated as this presidential race is, it seems like things have kind of been in the same place for a while. You know, Biden's base is with Biden, Trump's base is with Trump. Those numbers haven't really moved so much. And it looks it's close in the swing states where either of them really need to win. The thing that I'm watching out for tonight is misinformation and how fact checkers and the debate moderator handle when either of the candidates say things that aren't true. President Trump has done that with COVID numbers. And so it's a fine line, you know, correcting those things in real time so misinformation doesn't spread and allowing the debate to kind of continue on. And the other place where that happens is online on Twitter and Facebook. We've even seen today the story about Biden wearing an earpiece in the debate, which his campaign has denied. It's spread on Facebook like wildfire within a matter of hours.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'd love to hear from you if you have a particular candidate you're supporting, Biden or Trump. Also love to hear from you if you are undecided and think there might be something you might hear tonight or are looking to hear tonight to help you make the decision on who to vote for in the November 2020 presidential election. Anthony, Massachusetts is known as a blue state. It's known as a liberal state. The president actually locked horns with our own Republican governor by saying he's not really a Republican. I wonder, are there issues that you think are going to resonate in this debate tonight, specifically for Massachusetts voters or New England voters?
You know, I really look at this as a national race more than anything else, Tiziana. I mean, I think the same kind of issues that are going to resonate across the country are the issues that resonate here. I mean, we were talking about taxes a moment ago. I mean, I think the idea of fairness is certainly something that resonates with all voters. I think Joe Biden has good reason to bring that up and use that against President Trump. I mean,
here's a president who talked about, you know, his strongest suit was he knew how to run a business and he knew how to make money and he knew how to do all of that. And all these revelations of the New York Times really work against that. So I think those are interests. And then you talk about the main interests that we poll again and again on, things like health care, things like access to women's health care. These are important issues to folks in Massachusetts, just as they are to people all across the country. So I really look at this as much more of a kind of national focus, I think.
Stephanie, I found myself thinking, and I wonder if you have an answer or a thought on this. If you were going to pit one of the past presidential debaters from Massachusetts, people who were known to be quite good, Dukakis, Romney, Kerry, would any of their debating styles square up well against Trump tonight? Do we have a history here of strong debaters who would be good in this moment, and any lessons there for Biden?
Oh, my goodness. That is a tough question. I'm not sure I have an answer. Anthony, you might know better than me.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess I'd go back
Sorry.
I mean, everything is so, there's so much peril involved in this. I mean, you could think of Mike Dukakis, who was very good at not being phased, but that got him into trouble, right? When he was asked famously on the CNN debate about how he would respond to if his wife was raped, for example. And he stayed very cool and very calm and refused to sort of get involved in the sort of energy of the moment. And that got him in trouble. And I just go back to this idea that Trump is the master of chaos. And I can't imagine who would be the person who would best do it. But I think Joe Biden would just be well advised, you know, not to get in the mud pit with him, because.
So I think we might have lost Anthony's sound again. You know, this is always the challenge when we are broadcasting remotely.
It happens sometimes. I'm on the phone.
It happens sometimes, and I think we just got some sound with Anthony with the control room there. Stephanie, let's go to the phones for a second. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pamela, you are with us. Pamela's in Concord. What's on your mind?
I'm calling because I actually, I'm an independent, and I do support Trump, but I feel very uncomfortable because I feel like if I were to tell that to my colleagues, I could face being fired. I feel very worried about my position, and I've never felt like that before in this country.
I'm sorry that you feel that way. Stephanie, what about that?
I think it just speaks to kind of the heightened tension of the moment that we're in. You know, all of these different kind of catastrophes are happening on top of one another, the coronavirus, the economy, schools, all of these things. You know, it's a very heated political moment on either side of the aisle. And, you know, it really, like, it's palpable in the air. I think especially today, you know, this debate has been years in the making now.
Stephanie, I do want to talk about this fact-checking question. I was really interested to read an op-ed in the Boston Globe this weekend by John Keller, who was arguing that it is not the moderator's job to fact-check. I've heard other pundits in preparation for tonight say the moderator must fact-check Donald Trump. And I've heard others argue, no, Joe Biden must fact-check Donald Trump. One, how does that even work? And two, where is that responsibility? How much of that needs to get done real time?
That's a fantastic question. And I think with so many people tuning in and just, you know, kind of the speed of how this all works, some of that has to happen in real time, whether it's Joe Biden pushing back or the moderator pushing back. But, you know, something that the president often does is turn around and say that the fact-checking is fake news. And it's difficult to do that in real time. But the fact-checking that I'm most worried about is kind of what's going to happen online during and after the debate. You know, we saw during the Democratic primaries debate footage getting clipped and manipulated and changed to make things look different than they were during the debate. And so I think a lot of the onus beyond just what happens during that hour and a half time stretch is on kind of what happens online afterwards, where those moments are going to live on for days and weeks.
Anthony, do we have you?
I believe you have me. I'm really sorry about these technical issues.
It's okay. Let's laugh it off and keep going, because I've been really interested to ask you about this latest polling on New Hampshire. New Hampshire has four electoral votes on the line. They've become contested. They've become a swing state. And there's this new poll out today on Biden's lead over Trump from UMass Lowell Center on Public Opinion. It reminds us that actually 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump by fewer than 3,000 votes, which is a margin of less than 0.5%. So whither New Hampshire in the larger national picture here this time?
Yeah, it's an interesting poll. I mean, it speaks to a lot of issues. Joe Biden now has an 8-point lead, if this poll is correct. And as you said, that's quite a contrast with New Hampshire 4 years ago when she won by less than 0.5%. And I just think it speaks to this fact that this has been a remarkably stable race. And if you look at this poll, this is a big difference than 4 years ago. This poll in New Hampshire of New Hampshire voters, of likely voters, shows that 1% have not made up their mind. So only 1% of voters are undecided. And that really speaks to this issue of just how stable this race has been going back months and months and months. And basically, you know, Biden has had a lead in most of these battleground states that were identified a while ago, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and so forth. New Hampshire was one of them. But with an 8-point lead, it does look like it's slipping out of reach for Donald Trump. And it's interesting that he stopped spending advertising money here. And that could be a sign that he's much more interested in playing defense in the other larger battleground states. So New Hampshire feels like it might be slipping away from Trump at this point.
Stephanie, I may have time to grab one more call, but before I do, how are you feeling about the quality and reliability of polling versus in 2016 when, clearly the polling before the election did not steer us towards what was going to happen in that election?
That's a great question. And it seems like, you know, some of the mistakes in the polling from 2016. Historically, the national polling was pretty close to what it ended up being, with Hillary Clinton winning the popular vote. But a lot of those issues in the state level polls have been resolved. But going back to that New Hampshire point that Anthony made, I just think it's so interesting that Biden, on primary day in New Hampshire back in February, he actually left the state before the primary results came in because he knew he was going to do so poorly in that Democratic field. I think he came in fifth place. So the fact that he appears to be leading, according to that state poll that just came out in New Hampshire, leading over Trump in the state that Trump lost by the smallest margin in the entire country in 2016. You know, it's got to be something that feels personal to the Trump campaign. They've been wanting to win New Hampshire because it slipped away so closely. But, you know, just kind of the way that things have turned around for Biden there, I know a primary and a general election are much different, but, you know, it's just a very different thing than we were talking about even 6 months ago.
I want to get one more caller voice in here. We've got Sue on the line from Mashpee.
Hello.
Sue, go ahead. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm just calling because I feel that with the difficulty between the Democrats and the Republicans, that President Trump hasn't had a really good shake. I mean, he has come up with some really good things in his 4 years. One was, when we talk about the coronavirus, it was a difficult decision to make any decisions in the beginning because it was something new. And I think that he rallied to it. He had every day, he had Fauci tracking, and he sent as many supplies as he could to different places that needed them right away. It was a learning process. Fauci at one time said, we don't need masks. Another time,
Sue, I'm sorry to cut you short there. I do have to take it back from you, but I'm going to use your call to a last question to Anthony Brooks, which is, how does Donald Trump fare in the media analysis afterward? And for a caller like Sue, who's saying, I want him to get a fair shake, is that going to happen?
Well, I mean, we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, I appreciate the caller's point, but I mean, polls really do, if you look at public opinion at large, most Americans do believe that Donald Trump could have done more in terms of a better job in terms of handling this pandemic. And if you compare him to the way other countries, I'm thinking of the leader of Italy, for example, where there was a very concrete and coherent plan to lock the country down and slow things down. In fairness to the caller, the president created a lot of confusion about the path that Americans should take. And he was recommending to governors that they open up while open up businesses while numbers were still going up, for example. There was a lot of confusion about masks, but a lot of that confusion came from the president himself. And by the way, I went to a Trump rally just a few weeks ago in New Hampshire. Nobody was wearing masks, in spite of the fact that New Hampshire state law required masks. So it's very difficult for me to square what has actually happened with what the caller just expressed there. But I'll leave it at that.
All right. That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks very much.
Sure. My pleasure.
And Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook and co-host of the Horse Race podcast. Stephanie, thanks to you, too.
Thank you. So nice speaking with you.
In 2014, thousands of employees of local grocery store chain Market Basket walked off the job, rallying outside of the store's headquarters in Tewksbury in support of their fired CEO, Arthur T. Demoulas. The 40-day strike was remarkable. It was an act of collective action that made a difference. And that history inspired local writer Eric Giroux's first novel, Ring on Delhi. Giroux, who's also an attorney with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, joins us now on the line. Eric, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So you worked at the Bill Rickham Market Basket as a young person bagging groceries. Now, by the time Market Basket, the strikes happened, you were an onlooker. What struck you about 2014 and that moment of those strikes?
Well, I was impressed by the scale of them initially. I was inspired by the loyalty that these employees had for their company. And that company had done some really special things for them, which I only found out about later. So let me just focus on the moment of the protests. I just watched them from afar as a former sacker at Market Basket who liked working there as a teenager in a town, Billerica, where I grew up, that had three Market Baskets, where it was an important part of the economy and the culture. But what really impressed me about the protest was that they won. The pessimist in me is watching this and rooting for them. I drove up there with my wife to sign a petition to join one of the rallies in Tewksbury and to walk through the store and see what it looked like, kind of haunted and empty or nearly empty. And I was just really impressed that they managed to exercise the leverage of collective action to basically force the restoration of their beloved CEO, but also a business model that was pretty atypical for America.
So I want to hear a little sound from then. Eric, this is PBS NewsHour. This is a piece on the strike in 2014, and the sound is from the Tewksbury parking lot.
Heavenly Father, thank you for giving us today as a new day, even though we find ourselves in the same situation as yesterday, without our true leader, Arthur Demoulas.
What was started as an employee action is going to be finished as a customer action.
IDT has said a million times to me, we're in the grocery business second, the people business first.
You know, it just... so many different kinds of stories, right? There's the intersection of so many things going on there. Corporate social responsibility and employees fighting for a way of work and people who believe in their local business and their local community, but also the changing nature of how we buy food and how grocery stores. And then all of a sudden, you've got a novel out of it. How did you know that you wanted to tell all these kinds of stories and in this way?
Yeah. Sure. Well, I started writing a novel a long time ago about a grocery worker named Ray in a grocery store called Bounty Bag, which way back in that early draft was already kind of inspired by the Market Basket name. And I wanted to get down some of my experiences working in a supermarket and working in a deli. And I envisioned it as basically a humorous novel with not, I wasn't sure what else it would be about. But then when these protests happened, they reminded me, you know, I'm a Massachusetts guy. They reminded me of the American Revolution. You know, what happens to people when you try to take away from them self-government, you know, their ability to control their own destiny. And I wanted to touch on, you know, a couple of things that were special about or are special about Market Basket that I learned about from a book called We Are Market Basket, a nonfiction book by Daniel Korshun and Grant Welker. And they talked in there about how, you know, the corporate leadership has these values, the core values of solidarity and loyalty that's reciprocated. But more interesting to me, they have a decentralized business model. They really let local stores and local employees try out new ideas. And if they work locally, they scale them up and across the chain. They also have a generous profit sharing plan to give out, you know, bonuses to these supermarket workers and to help them out in emergencies. But that idea that you could, you know, have a role in shaping the business place where you work and that you were treated with respect, the customers were treated with respect. It was about the whole community, not just the shareholders. That really appealed to me. And I thought I could have some fun tying it to bigger themes of democracy or American history.
Yeah, let's have you read. So now we've got Ray, right, who's still the protagonist in this book, who is in the middle of sort of unexpectedly in the middle of a revolution. Let's have you read just a little bit. It's from early in the novel, and you're describing Ray's pride to be essentially the, I think he's the manager at this point at Bounty Bag's deli counter, but also his feelings about some of his coworkers. Can you just read that for us?
Sure. He's the assistant manager. He has a green jacket, but has a stripe on it for his, he doesn't have the stripe yet. So here we go. In Ray's opinion, Bounty Bag was the world's best supermarket and store number 28, the chain's crown jewel, its godforsaken Penacook location notwithstanding. But on a sour day, as this was shaping up to be, Delhi was like some Penacook lesion on Bounty Bag's flank, welling and oozing with weak links and health reg outlaws like the Alfredo and Toothless Mary. Delhi had a chronic retention problem, too, and they were currently hiring for at least a couple of slots. Ray now wondered if he was no better than the Alfredo and Toothless Mary. Did he, too, have some defect that only others could see? Was he, like them, more Penacook than Bounty Bag?
So this is really interesting to me because Penacook is the town where this Bounty Bag happens to be. And the first half of the book is very hard on all these different Penacook characters. They're kind of Carl Hiaasen style characters. And then, you know, as you go forward, these grocery store employees become heroes of a story that's much larger than themselves. And that is so interesting in this moment where frontline workers like grocery store employees have experienced such an arc from being in danger early in the pandemic to being celebrated in the next phase of the pandemic to being ignored and still underpaid where we are now in the pandemic. How do you think your story about these characters who are sort of pathetic heroes play out against the backdrop of the moment we're in?
Well, I mean, we've done a lot of the last few decades to weaken the position of people who work in grocery stores and people who work in other low wage but essential enterprises. So the things that people, don't respect are, you know, let's take a closer look and see what these people are really about. That's what I say. And when the COVID-19 hit, we, for a brief moment, appreciated this valiant and sometimes fatal willingness of grocery workers to go in and do this job. And we may be back in that position very soon, where grocery stores are the only, symbol of abundance and plenty and predictability that we have. So I hope that we continue to value not just grocery workers, but, everybody who's out there going to work day after day, collecting a paycheck, usually for doing work that has real social value, really helps other people.
Eric, I ask you this not as a gotcha question. Are you going to the grocery store these days? Is that how you're getting your food? Are you going into grocery stores?
Yes.
And how does that feel now with this book under your belt?
Oh, I think about it too much. Every time I'm in a grocery store, I'm thinking about the different techniques and tricks that they're using to promote products. And, Market Basket has respect for the customer in that way as well. They don't engage in so many tricks. Actually, Bounty Bag, the fictitious supermarket in my novel, has a lot more tricks up its sleeve when it comes to customers. But I love the supermarket. It's always a place, a bright place, a place of abundance. And I'm always, trying to show the proper respect for everyone who works there, because I know they're taking a big risk just from going to work right now.
And just a couple of sentences, Eric, that was your first novel, Ring on Deli, rooted in your own experience. What's next?
I'm not sure, but I have a placeholder answer. Anytime someone asks me that, I say I'm writing a novel that'll be called Mark Twain in Hawaii, because that sounds like a hit novel to me, but I don't know if it'll be about Mark Twain in Hawaii. We'll see.
Could be some fun field research, though.
That's right.
That is Eric Giroux. He's an attorney and a writer, and Ring on Deli is his first novel. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.